potential threats by observing how others use space. Proxemics involves two main elements: distance, as it reveals relationships or attitudes, and movement, as an indicator of intention. Distance. Proxemics provides combat profilers with the ability to evaluate groups of people and determine significant aspects of the relationships between them and their attitudes toward one another. The group's relationships in space provide the observer with a wealth of information about each individual in the group, as well as the group as a whole. Anthropologist Edward T. Hall has defined four proxemic zones. These zones are the general distances that people maintain from one another, depending upon their level of comfort with one another. Although specific distances are culturally dependent, the four zones are still valid ways of using the distance between people to make a determination about their relationships. Hall's four zones are the intimate, the personal, the social, and the public. 1. The intimate zone. The intimate zone is the area that is closest to the body. It is the space normally reserved only for people in the closest of relationships: spouses, boyfriends and girlfriends, children, parents, and very close friends are usually the only people willingly permitted into this area. This area is well within arm's reach and provides the most risk for someone to do harm. This is the reason people are selective about who is granted access into this space. At times, the intimate zone boundary is crossed without consent. There are many reasons that this could occur. One of these reasons could be because one person is attempting to establish dominance over another. Since a proxemic violation occurs when some actual harm is done by the invasion, the person violating the proxemic boundary may be trying to make the other person feel uncomfortable and ultimately submissive to either gain or maintain influence. These times when people are forced into socially close situations will cause a limbic system response as the body prepares to deal with the threat. A person whose intimate zone has been violated and who feels defensive or uncomfortable may put up barriers or display pacifying behaviors, kinesics, begin to blush, biometrics, or move away from the person to reestablish proper separation, proxemics. There are situations in which violations of the intimate zone become unavoidable, such as on crowded city streets, in airplanes, elevators, or in professional environments like a doctor's office, a beauty parlor, or a barbershop. People are generally acutely aware of invasions, not only because they don't want others intruding on their space, but also because they don't want to violate the space of others. In such situations, there is an expectation that others will make an effort to maintain the proper distance. When that is not the case, the limbic system recognizes a potential threat and responds accordingly. 2. The personal zone. The personal zone is the second smallest circle surrounding a person. It is the space within which most friends and acquaintances interact. This distance is generally about arm's length, and is the conversational separation at which most daily interaction is conducted. People who operate in this zone generally have some relationship, but are not close enough to allow each other into the intimate zone. As with the intimate zone, situations arise in which individuals are forced into one another's personal zone, such as in shopping malls, restaurants, or public transportation. The kinesic cluster of interested versus uninterested will provide confirmation that this boundary has been violated. Signs that two people are comfortable within each other's personal zones may be an acknowledgement between them, such as eye contact, nods, feet or torso turning toward the person, or handshakes. If no indicators of a positive relationship exist, this could indicate that the two are intentionally trying to avoid each other. 3. Social and public zones. The social and public zones are the two largest zones. These are the distances at which people prefer to keep strangers. The two zones are addressed jointly in this section because both indicate the same relationship: no relationship. Why do people tend to keep strangers at a distance? Safety. As distance increases, the options available to an attacker decrease. For the purposes of combat profiling, The social and public zones are beyond arm's length. How people interact with the space around and between them is a significant dynamic and predictor of human behavior anywhere in the world. Proximic distance can indicate the nature of relationships between people of a group and relationships between groups. Identifying the proximic zones between people does not require that the observer may be up close and personal. Observation can be done with standoff, i.e., sufficient distance to protect oneself, using binoculars or other optics. This observation is one that the combat profiler must study and master. The objective, remember, is to place ourselves and those we are protecting left of Bang. A note about cultural differences. The exact distance of the four zones described above varies from culture to culture. On a recent trip to Tokyo, a Japanese male and an American Marine were observed in conversation. The Japanese man continually tried to move closer to the Marine to establish the conversational distance customary in Japanese culture. Each time he did so, the Marine backed away, seeking the comfort, to him, of the normal American conversational distance. This proximic dance continued throughout the encounter. Movement. If distance is the first element of proximics, movement is the second. People move for a purpose, and the way a person moves can reveal that person's intentions. A predator creeping in for the kill looks different than a person casually searching for a friend, and an attacker with violent intentions moving quickly toward his or her target looks different than a person rapidly approaching a friend with excitement. The ability to determine intentions from motion is a skill evolved by humans over millions of years. As one study states, one of our most fundamental cognitive adaptations is the ability to infer the intentions of others. Combat profilers classify movement into three categories: movement toward, movement away, and idle movement. Movement toward can be both positive and negative. It can mean friendly or hostile intent. Movement away can mean evasion or flight, or simply movement away from one thing toward another without any negative intention. Idle movement can include activities such as waiting or other benign purposes, but can also communicate surveillance. Combat profilers must distinguish between these types of movement. The best way to learn is practice, to place ourselves in scenarios where we can observe different intentional movements and develop file folders on each type. Imagine you are walking along a busy street. People are passing in every direction. Most are paying no attention to you. No one is increasing or decreasing his speed relative to yours, and no one is changing his direction. You can quickly rule out that anyone ahead of you is attempting to evade you. You observe those individuals who are facing you and walking toward you. Again, no one seems to notice you. No one increases or decreases his speed. Their angles relative to you remain the same. The few people who are walking close to your path do change their direction a bit to avoid you. You can quickly infer that none of these people is a threat. However, as you glance to your rear, you notice one individual who does seem to be increasing his speed and whose angle and direction matches yours. As you turn down a side street, he turns the same way. You increase your speed, he matches it. You cross the road. When you turn back, you see that this individual has changed his angle and direction to take the shortest route to your location, and he is now in a dead sprint. Apart from his facial expressions or other body language, you can quickly infer that he is chasing you. You must now determine if the person following you is a threat. Kinesics and biometrics help you to do so. Proximic pushes and pulls. A foundational dynamic of human nature is that people will approach things they like and which they expect will deliver pleasure, and avoid things that are unappealing or could cause them pain. In combat profiling, movement toward a person or thing is called a proximic pull. The opposite, movement away, is a proximic push. 1. Proximic pull. A proximic pull occurs when a person or group is drawn to another person, group, object, or place. Proximic pulls occur for many reasons. Because the person being pulled is interested. Because the other person, object, or place can fulfill a need. a relationship or association exists, or there is a degree of attraction and curiosity. Proximic pulls occur when someone does not perceive any threat, so the body is not prepared for fight or flight. Proximic pulls are significant to combat profilers because they focus the profiler's attention on specific interactions that provide insight into the group being observed. Proximic pulls are indicators that some person or element stands out from the baseline. If people are attracted and drawn to a person, combat profilers should either continue to observe that person or contact that individual to figure out what makes that person significant. Consider a drug dealer operating on a street. This individual will be continually approached by others and will have a high degree of situational awareness. His interactions will exhibit significant hand-to-hand contact, which is the obvious sign of possible drug deals. Although the hand-to-hand contact is the indicator of illegal activity, it is the proximic pull that will initially draw the combat or law enforcement profiler's attention. Marines deployed overseas deal with this dynamic every day. On many patrols, Marines will designate one member as the Candyman. The Candyman is the Marine with the backpack full of sweets, pens, pencils, and anything else to give to the local kids. As soon as the Candyman has been discovered by the local children, other youngsters are proximically pulled to that one Marine. While the Candyman pull can be a benefit for Marines as they strive to build relationships with the locals so they can root out the enemy, the enemy often uses these proximic pulls to their advantage as well by staging attacks as people congregate. 2. Negative proximic pull. Suicide bombers seek centers of proximic pull, a market, a house of worship, a medical support mission. They go where the highest number of people are. A stark proximic reality is that less skilled attackers need to get close to us to harm us. This makes it critical for profilers to recognize when proximic pulls are occurring and to be alert for these potential threats. Insurgents also attempt to use proximic pulls as a means to bait Americans into areas where they may be attacked. Insurgents don't have an endless supply of equipment, munitions, or manpower. They must be more efficient in where they choose to strike. They can do this in one of two ways, either by studying our tactics, habits, and patterns to predict where we might be in the future, or by doing something to draw American forces into an area where they, the enemy, are waiting. Insurgents might use several tactics to create a proximic pull. Cause a civil disturbance to force standby forces to deploy. Emplace a decoy IED to force explosive specialists to respond. Open fire on a patrol. Then flee to cause the patrol to give chase. By understanding the enemy's method of proximic pulls, patrol leaders can use tactical cunning to think through where the enemy is trying to pull the patrol and outmaneuver the enemy instead of getting ambushed. 3. Proximic push. A proximic push is the opposite of a proximic pull. It is the movement away from another person, place, or object. A proximic push occurs to avoid a real or potential threat, or because of fear or uncertainty created by a lack of knowledge. In contrast to the proximic pull, there is usually a flight element to the decision to move away from a perceived threat. In civilian society, individuals rarely find themselves in situations that require immediate physical flight. That doesn't mean that proximic pushes don't happen every day. The businessman being criticized by his superior during a committee meeting may roll his chair backwards a few inches and then lean even farther away to create as much separation from his boss as possible without making the discomfort obvious. The need to separate oneself from a threat is universal. The combat profiler can and must be aware of this. Patrols by U.S. forces in foreign nations, such as Afghanistan, have a tendency to pull children toward them. However, at times, a U.S. force may encounter situations in which children or other locals purposefully avoid patrols. Do the locals have advanced warning of an impending ambush? Have the locals been threatened by insurgents with consequences if they interact with or help the American forces? In these situations, an American patrol has caused a proximic push. Children and other locals are repelled for reasons of their own survival. Good guys and bad guys are continually engaging in a proxemic push and pull dance. As always, the combat profiler must establish the baseline and then immediately hunt for anomalies. In proxemics, these anomalies are defined by two distinct factors, distance and movement. Imagine your patrol has entered a village. Your squad car drives into a neighborhood. The first anomaly that should alert a profiler is a sudden change in proxemic behavior, especially avoidance, proxemic push. When people suddenly grant greater proxemic space than is normal, it is likely that they have been pushed away from something to ensure their own safety and survival. The second anomaly is decreased proxemic standoff. Have individuals placed themselves closer, anomaly, than they should be, baseline? Are they moving even closer? Is that movement accelerating? The domain of proxemics is about identifying and confirming people's relationships and intentions based on how they interact with the space around them. These fundamentals of proxemics can be applied anywhere in the world. While the physical distances will change for the different proxemic zones, the zones will still imply the same information about the relationships that people have with each other. Just like the other domains discussed up to this point, the proxemic zones and proxemic pushes and pulls are observations that people have been making their entire lives. The only difference is that combat profiling is now classifying and defining behavior, which allows for more intelligent decisions that can be communicated to other people to explain the human behavior being observed. Key takeaways. Proxemics. 1. Proxemics is the interpretation of space between people and other people or objects. 2. Intimate zone, reserved for only the closest of relationships, inside one arm's length distance. 3. Personal zone, reserved for friends and acquaintances, generally about one arm's distance. 4. Social and public zones, distance where strangers are maintained. 5. Proxemic pull, the physical movements toward a person or object, likely caused by things that are considered attractive, safe, and positive. 6. Proxemic push, the physical movement away from a person or object, likely caused by things that are considered harmful, unappealing, and negative. 6. Geographics. What are geographics? In Los Angeles, every street is claimed by one gang or another. It doesn't matter if it is in the suburbs or the street the police station is on. A gang will claim they own it. Some streets are more contested than others, but the first step in understanding crime here is to understand who has claimed what. Los Angeles Police Officer Gang Task Force. The first principle of geographics is that human beings, and animals as well, act with greater confidence in areas with which they are familiar. Home field advantage is real. Individuals move fluidly, comfortably, and confidently in areas they feel at home in, and more deliberately, slowly, and with greater caution in areas where they don't know the lay of the land. Crime and insurgent activity occurs almost always in settings where the criminal and the insurgent have established a high degree of fluency and familiarity. Because of this, Marines and law enforcement professionals need to be capable of identifying individuals and groups who have developed an intuitive understanding of their environment. This begins by studying how people move through their neighborhoods and villages with which they are familiar. Who is the enemy? Where is he? As you, the combat profiler, seek the foe hiding in plain sight and in plain clothes, the domain of geographics is indispensable. Geographics allows you to make assessments about the relationship between the people and the village, the neighborhood, and the land. Geographics provides a methodology for breaking down the area of operations into manageable sections, areas in which the enemy conducts attacks, areas in which he lives or is based, and paths and byways by which he moves from one location to another. Just as the skilled hunter knows his prey's tracks and trails, dens and sleeping sites, so we combat profilers must learn not just the enemy, but the ground he moves upon, takes shelter in, and from which he strikes. 1. Natural lines of drift. If you have ever seen the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, consider the scene where Ferris is in a race to beat his mom back home so that he won't get caught ditching school. Ferris knew the beeline route. He knew which fences to jump and which backyards to cut through. He knew the way home as intimately as insurgents crossing from Pakistan to Afghanistan know the rat lines through the mountains. He knew the natural lines of drift, NLDs. The combat profiler must know these lines, too. To identify where the enemy will be, we must learn how he intends to get there. In any environment, humans and animals will seek the path of least resistance. In anthropological terms, movement is costly, and in order for most types of movement to be worthwhile, getting to the goal should not cost more in time, energy, safety, etc., than it is worth to get there. When traveling from one place to another, people take paths that are simple, safe, and obstacle-free. Note, this is not always the shortest way. Additionally, every environment is shaped in ways that provide certain natural paths for people to follow. This is as true in urban environments as it is in rural environments. The combination of these factors, simple, safe, and obstacle-free paths that follow the natural outlay of the area, create NLDs. Once the combat profiler begins to look for these pathways, he starts seeing them everywhere. NLDs may be paths worn through mulched plant beds in mall parking lots, game trails through the woods, or openings in fences. Combat profilers can use NLDs to predict where and how the enemy will travel. Identifying NLDs is critical because these are the paths the enemy often takes to move between his base of operations and the places he conducts attacks. Marines normally consider NLDs when thinking tactically. Patrol leaders will plan routes, hide sites, observation posts, and other tactical activities away from NLDs. Since NLDs are routes that locals frequently take, Marines normally make every effort to avoid them to avoid detection and limit the risk of being observed and compromised. In fact, for groups such as snipers, being too close to NLDs can prove fatal. When analyzing terrain with an offensive mindset, Marines use NLDs to establish ambush sites, since the enemy may often follow NLDs when patrolling. Like Marines planning an ambush, combat profilers should consider NLDs as something to be exploited. NLDs indicate how people move through a neighborhood, tree line, or other types of terrain. Enemy personnel use NLDs just like the rest of the local populace. For combat profilers, NLDs show how people use the surrounding terrain. Furthermore, when observing NLDs, combat profilers can use the other domains, biometrics and kinesics, to identify potential anomalies. Proximically, anyone who avoids NLDs should also be considered an anomaly. The concept of NLDs is not just theoretical. It's a principle that criminals live by. A Los Angeles Police Department officer who has spent the majority of his career studying and combating gang violence in the Hollenbeck District tells about a time early in his career when he would chase gang members through alleyways. The gang members knew the locations of all the footholds in walls and fences that could be used to help them jump these obstacles and keep one step ahead of the pursuing police. Individuals, including criminals, do not move randomly through their environment. Over time, this gang officer had studied his area so thoroughly that he knew all the side streets and alley getaways, knew where most of the gang members lived or would go to hide, and was able to operate as effectively in that area as the criminals themselves. The principle of natural lines of drift can be applied in combat zones by looking at an area of operation to find creative ways to target insurgents. Homegrown insurgents will always know their neighborhoods and villages better than our deployed forces. An insurgent planting an IED will not transit by main roads or heavily patrolled byways. He'll use obscure alleys and backstreets, and if he's spotted, he'll know all the trapdoors and escape routes to make his getaway. Finding these natural lines of drift is extremely important, and can often be done by incorporating the art of tracking into your patrols as a way to determine how many people travel a certain path, how often they come through, and the last time that they were there. Once you have found these pathways around an area where you think an ambush may occur, you will be able to respond much more quickly in predicting how the enemy will leave the area, allowing you to cut off his escape routes. Habitual areas and anchor points. To the combat profiler, individuals congregate in one of two places, habitual areas and anchor points. A habitual area is a place where anyone can come or go at any time. An anchor point is the opposite. An anchor point is a place whose ownership has been claimed by a particular person or group, either formally or informally, and is identified by the existence of pre-established criteria to gain entry. The local mall is a habitual area. Tony Soprano's Bada Bing Club is an anchor point. Habitual areas. The function of habitual areas is the same all over the world. Although a mall in America looks different than a bazaar in the Middle East, both places exist to provide the necessary commodities that people need to live. National attire may differ, and the types of products for sale may vary. But the layout and design of markets, or other similar places, is often very similar across cultures. Human behavior, regardless of location, will display a great number of parallels. The student combat profiler doesn't need to travel to Bangladesh or Burkina Faso to learn his trade. We can learn a lot right here at home. Developing thick file folders for American settings can go a long way toward increasing a combat profiler's recognition capabilities and decision-making abilities. Instead of focusing on differences between cultures, the student combat profiler should focus on the similarities in human behavior at these locations. Because the insurgencies our country has been fighting for the last decade are people and population-centric fights, Marines on patrol naturally operate in crowded and heavily populated areas. Because of that, Marines often find themselves in the marketplaces and gathering sites to interact with locals. The catch is that Marines aren't the only ones attracted to these areas. Criminals and insurgents also view habitual areas as places of opportunity. In such settings, bad guys will, of course, do their best to blend in with the locals. Once a Marine has established a baseline for the habitual area, he can then begin observing and hunting for the anomalies. The wolves in sheep's clothing will easily stand out, because their behavior will not fit the baseline. Habitual areas are points of attraction, markets, bazaars, public squares. But there will also be points within habitual areas that have restricted access and that people seek to avoid. In any city, habitual area, you will find neighborhoods where not everyone feels welcome. In outdoor markets that are open to the public, there will be stores and booths where only certain people are permitted. The next section will discuss the category we call anchor points, where not everyone is welcome. It is important for the combat profiler to understand that within neighborhoods, malls, city streets, buildings, and even a single room, there are always locations that are off limits to outsiders. Anchor points. Consider a family's house. Under one roof are both habitual areas, kitchen, living room, bathroom, and anchor points. The parents may not allow everyone to enter their bedroom. Dad may have a study or workshop that others enter at their own risk. Teenagers, of course, are universally protective of their private space. One level higher, the house itself may be considered the family's anchor point, the place from which the family as a whole operates and within whose walls only certain outsiders are welcome. Moving up a few levels, a town or village possesses both habitual areas and anchor points. Habitual areas include the downtown area and the market. Anchor points are those areas to which only certain people are permitted access. A gang-controlled area of a neighborhood is a type of anchor point. An anchor point is a home base. It's a place from which a person or group operates. An anchor point may be identified by the volume of traffic coming and going, and by the emotional attachment it evokes in those who belong. It is the place that a person or group visits regularly, and it's often the most important place in that person's or group's life. For most people, their home is their anchor point. Criminals and insurgents may not necessarily use their home as an anchor point, but may have some other location from which they operate. These anchor points may be fixed or mobile, temporary or permanent. Most crime happens in the vicinity of a criminal's anchor point, in those areas with which he or she is most familiar. The same can be assumed for insurgents. Since insurgents often work in teams, they usually operate from some type of centralized base. That base is their anchor point. Identifying anchor points will help the combat profiler to develop a baseline from which to predict human behavior. The question becomes, how are anchor points identified? Anchor points are not identified by their location, and often not even by the way the place looks. Anchor points are identified based upon the behavior of the people at that location. The following are behavioral characteristics and patterns that can help to identify anchor points. 1. Only certain people have access to the location. Visitors are vetted. Strangers must meet some type of screening criteria to be granted permission to enter. 2. The place is protected and defended. Access is controlled by security personnel such as doormen or bouncers. Lookouts or outposts may provide early warning of any unauthorized approach. Should someone gain access who is not welcome, there will be retaliation for trespassing. 3. Locals in the area who know of the anchor point may go out of their way to avoid it. In this instance, we see simultaneously both the proxemic push of repulsion to outsiders and the proxemic pull of members being drawn to the location. Human beings are territorial. Groups take possession of space. Nations have borders. Gangs have turf. Whenever we observe behavior characterized by identification with a geographic area in a way that indicates ownership, we also expect that ownership to involve defense of that territory against perceived invaders. People will fight for what is theirs. Temporary anchor points. Anchor points don't always come in the form of buildings, and they don't have to be established for long periods of time. Two gang members take a position on a street corner, talking loudly and making a scene. How comfortable will people feel walking past with small children? That corner has become a temporary anchor point. When the gang members move away, the temporary anchor point vanishes with them, reverting to being a habitual area. Temporary anchor points are quite common. You will see them whenever a person or group occupies an area for a limited time, such as park benches, a spot on the beach with chairs and towels, seats on public transportation, tables at an outdoor cafe, or a place in line. Criminal versus personal anchor points. All criminals and insurgents have anchor points, but not all anchor points are criminal. The home of an underground leader, for instance, may be a personal anchor point, in that the leader will not be available to the population in that location. A religious leader may be willing to talk to anybody while he is at the religious center, but may still consider his private residence to be off-limits. A person's home will become an anchor point for a variety of reasons, but isn't necessarily a criminal anchor point. Combat profilers should focus their searches on criminal and insurgent anchor points. Criminals and insurgents need a haven where they feel secure in conducting their planning and preparations, whether it's a member's home, a local bar or meeting place, a safe house, etc. This location will also be the place to which the criminal returns immediately following the crime. To target criminals and insurgents effectively, the combat profiler must be able to identify these sanctuaries and force them to move by removing their perception of security. People are always more vulnerable on the move. And if we continue to eliminate safe havens and anchor points for criminals, our ability to neutralize and eliminate them will increase exponentially. Finding criminal anchor points. Criminals and insurgents are not going to make identifying their anchor points easy. Every care will be taken to conceal such secure areas. Combat profilers must search for cues that are often extremely subtle and covert. Locals may unwittingly reveal the location of anchor points by walking out of their way to avoid a certain building or block within their village. In the language of combat profiling, this is a proxemic push. Marines on patrol must remain alert to changes in the body language of locals as the patrol approaches a seemingly innocent location. Do people move away? Does their demeanor alter from comfortable and open to uncomfortable and defensive? Graffiti, flags, or other insignia may indicate the presence of a criminal or insurgent anchor point. Buffer space is another characteristic that can help us locate an anchor point. A buffer zone is the demilitarized area surrounding an anchor point. This space provides the criminal or insurgent with a level of comfort and security. Criminals and insurgents do not usually conduct crimes and attacks within this space because of the risk of getting caught or of having their anchor point identified. Butch Cassidy did not rob trains within 100 miles of his hideout at Hole in the Wall. The criminal is protecting his neighbors as well by not bringing hostile security forces into their backyard, as he expects these neighbors to shield him by keeping their mouths shut. The buffer zone keeps criminals and insurgents from operating too close to home. The combat profiler should look for areas that, though surrounded by instances of criminal activity, remain remarkably immune to attacks and crime. This may be an indicator of an anchor point surrounded by a buffer zone. Visual assessment of this area may then confirm the presence of an anchor point based on the behavior of locals and the people at the assumed anchor point. The reward for identifying criminal and insurgent anchor points will be an exponential increase in the effectiveness of patrols and other security operations. By forcing the insurgents to react to our presence and actions and removing the security they were seeking when they established their anchor point, will allow us to maintain offensive and proactive actions in the hunt. Geographics in history. Before his death in 2011, there had been two very public attempts on Osama bin Laden's life since September 11, 2001. The first one was executed in December 2001 in Tora Bora, a mountainous region on Afghanistan's eastern border, dubbed Operation Anaconda. The assault began with Afghan troops supported by U.S. Special Operations Forces and American aerial bombing, followed a few days later by an area sweep conducted by soldiers of the U.S. 10th Mountain Division. Ultimately, bin Laden escaped this hunt. But the concept of geographics can provide us with an instructive picture of the episode. Tora Bora was an anchor point. It was a place where Osama bin Laden felt secure. Tora Bora was surrounded by a buffer zone. Bin Laden could eat, sleep, confer with Confederates, and plan operations, knowing that he had abundant early warning of transgressors. Tora Bora was close to the Pakistan border, should the Al-Qaeda leader need to flee the country, and the area was filled with loyal followers willing to defend him against any attackers. Operation Anaconda failed by not securing a cordon around the village and blocking the egress routes leading out of Tora Bora. In the mission plan, this task was left mostly to the Afghan forces, and while they did establish checkpoints on the main routes, due to a lack of sufficient manpower, they left mountain trails and goat paths unsecured. During the course of the fight, Osama bin Laden was escorted out of Tora Bora by 40 or 50 fighters who had an extensive knowledge of the area and who used the natural lines of drift, those goat paths, to get him out fast. According to reports after the operation in Tora Bora, many believe that bin Laden did not return to Pakistan as originally thought. With an American bounty on his head, he did not feel safe in that country. Instead, it is believed that he went north towards Jalalabad and established a new anchor point. The key criterion in creating an anchor point is the ability to ensure security and exclusivity of access. As history shows, bin Laden correctly assessed that the tribes in Jalalabad would provide better security than what he would have received in Pakistan, as he remained free for almost another decade. Consider how the concepts of combat profiling helped ultimately to locate and kill Osama bin Laden. The primary search was for bin Laden's anchor point. This ended with the identification of a compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. Instead of the mountain cave that many in U.S. intelligence predicted would be his hideout, bin Laden was holed up on the third floor of a million-dollar compound that had 12-foot-high concrete walls topped with barbed wire, further protected by two security fences. Besides the obvious protection, the anomalies began to mount. U.S. agencies discovered that the compound lacked a phone or internet connection, though such amenities could be acquired with ease in affluent Abbottabad. Observers discovered that the walled compound burned its own trash instead of putting it out for collection like the rest of the town. This, along with other evidence, allowed our intelligence agencies to focus their search on that building to confirm their assumptions. As they were planning the raid, they kept in mind the natural lines of drift that bin Laden would use to escape, and kept a helicopter-borne response force on standby should they need reinforcements for an immediate search if bin Laden managed to escape the house. Abbottabad itself was a habitual area that Pakistanis would go to visit during the heat of the summer, but it was the act of sorting through the people there and identifying it as an anchor point with key anomalies that allowed the Americans to target the most wanted terrorist in the world. The successful result of the attack shows how geographics can help us narrow our focus from a large habitual area, in this case, an entire region of the globe, into smaller observable segments and make more educated plans and decisions. Geographics summary. If the combat profiler can identify an anchor point, habitual areas, and NLDs, he or she can begin to predict human behavior within a geographic area. A baseline can be established even before he or she enters the location. This will greatly reduce the time it takes to orient himself or herself to any potential threats or anomalies. This will increase our predictive and therefore proactive nature on the battlefield. Understanding these geographical concepts allows us to further understand and forecast criminal acts. We know that bad guys will leave their anchor point, whether it is their home or a safe house, when they are ready to conduct their next crime. The crime will likely occur in a habitual area, whose terrain they are familiar with, and within whose population they both feel secure and can blend in. They will use NLDs both to approach their target and to withdraw from it. Additionally, we know that bad guys don't just target habitual areas, but they choose also to target areas that they are familiar with, which offer them an increased level of confidence in the ultimate success of their crime. Understanding the relationship that people have with their environment can let you predict human behavior and movement long before an action takes place. It is a crucial aspect of understanding humans. Geographics takeaways. 1. People act differently in an area depending on whether they are familiar or unfamiliar with the environment. 2. NLDs are the pathways that people take that allow for a simple and safe movement from point A to point B, while exerting the least amount of effort. 3. Habitual areas are places where any person can visit without restriction. 4. Anchor points are places where only people who meet an exclusive set of requirements are granted access. 5. Anchor points can be identified by places where access is controlled. 6. Identifying criminal anchor points is the focus of effort for security forces seeking to disrupt criminal, insurgent, and terrorist activities. 7. Iconography. Iconography is visual language. We see it everywhere, as symbols on t-shirts, tattoos, graffiti on buildings, traffic signs, advertisements, and the images companies use to identify and market their products. An icon is any symbol used to promote a person's or group's presence, beliefs, or affiliations. Individuals and groups use iconography to draw allies and converts to them, to intimidate enemies and drive them away, to further their agendas, to boast, to brag, to bully, and to buffalo. Iconography often communicates complex messages through simple pictures, symbols, and writing. But why should combat profilers pay heed to iconography? Iconography is not directly an aspect of human behavior. It is not driven by the limbic system or autonomic processes. Iconography, particularly personal iconography, is easily masked or hidden, for example, tattoos, or changed, for example, clothing. We include iconography as one of the domains because combat profilers can use iconography to increase their situational awareness. Paying attention to iconography opens the combat profiler's eyes to messages being communicated by symbols in the environment. By analyzing and understanding the iconography present in any human situation, the combat profiler can determine the beliefs of an individual or group. He can tell that person or group's affiliation. Who are their allies? Who are their enemies? What do they stand for? Combat profilers can observe iconography to understand what things are important in an area to individuals and groups, and what elements are influencing the people in an area. By identifying the changes in iconography over time, combat profilers can understand how and in which direction a political, social, or military situation is trending. Iconography can be divided into two realms: indicators that appear on people, and indicators that appear in geographical environments. In a geographical environment, iconography can tell us 1. The intent or beliefs of those who imprinted the iconography. 2. Whether groups in the area are in conflict. And 3. The relationship between the people who live in the area and the people who left the iconography. Regarding this last point, there is a significant difference between allowing the iconography to remain in place, for example, graffiti or political or religious slogans scrawled on walls, or taking action to eradicate it or paint over it. In the first case, the community tolerates and may actively embrace the beliefs and agenda of those imprinting the iconography. In the second, the local population resists or is attempting to disassociate itself from the purveyors of the iconography. The iconography that individuals display on their person also provides important information. First, we can determine what types of things a person supports or doesn't support, particularly if the iconography displays a negative message about something. Second, we can tell what a person's associations are. Third, we can tell a person's status or assumed status, i.e., what they believe their status is. Personal iconography is important to the average person, but significantly more important to the criminal. It bears emphasizing that especially in the criminal population, symbols and external markings acquire tenfold meaning and have great value and a significant function. The criminal world often uses symbols that are considered illicit or illegitimate in the law-abiding world. Criminals choose symbols that often go against the norm. There are three main categories of iconography that combat profilers should be aware of: graffiti and other forms of public iconography, tattoos, and clothing and other artifacts. Graffiti. Graffiti is any writing or drawing on a public place done without the consent of the owner of the space. Three types of graffiti are of concern to the combat profiler: territorial graffiti, tagging done by groups to identify their territory; political and ideological graffiti, graffiti which expresses some type of political or belief statement; and threatening graffiti, graffiti that menaces or attempts to intimidate others, specifically local or foreign security forces, or inspires others to do so. Territorial graffiti is used by gangs and similar groups to let outsiders know that they are trespassing on turf claimed by the gang. Often a gang's territory is marked by boundary graffiti, which indicates the limits of the gang's home ground. Graffiti increases the more deeply one penetrates to the heart of the territory. Graffiti is often a real-time indicator of local attitudes, and as one study argues, graffiti can be a prelude and a directive to open behavior and clues to the bounds and intensity of a community's control of its territory. Other public iconography includes artifacts such as flags, signs, even colors. These are often indicators of what type of groups are operating in an area, or what type of groups the people in the area support. Flags are prominent means of providing group identity and solidarity. A flag advertises a group's presence in an area. It establishes a rallying point for the group's members. Flags are also often rich in symbolism. Many provide extensive clues to the values and ideologies of the group. Consider the symbols and colors of the American flag. The various Taliban flags, which have been used since that group emerged in the early 1990s, have not only served as icons, but also have, by their presence, made powerful political statements. After a battle between U.S. and Taliban forces in late 2009, the Taliban raised a flag in the province of Nuristan in eastern Afghanistan as a statement of what they claimed was a victory. This was a significant attempt by the Taliban to influence the local people, an act of demonstrating their power and their claim to ownership of the area. In contrast, forces loyal to the Afghan government raised their national flag over the city of Marja to demonstrate their victory over Taliban forces in early 2010. In addition to flags, other public iconography includes the simple display of colors. The blue bandana of the Crips and the red of the Bloods are recognized in every American city. In recent years, businesses in Los Angeles, with ties to the terrorist groups in the Arab world, have begun displaying colors with Middle Eastern significance. Colors are often given meaning by the groups that use them. Red frequently carries the meaning of sacrifice due to its association with blood. White often indicates purity. Black may indicate death. The key is to understand the significance of colors in whatever area you are operating. In addition to flags and colors, any sign, flyer, or other public symbol should be assessed to determine its significance. Tattoos. Because tattoos are permanent, they often possess extremely significant meaning for the wearer. The location on the person's body may be meaningful as well. Tattoos are meant to gain attention and to communicate a message. The most important for the combat profiler include 1. Membership in a group, specifically a gang, insurgent, terrorist operation, or extremist organization. 2. Association or identification with a specific cause, especially one that espouses violence. 3. Symbols representing past incarceration. The number of Americans with tattoos remains relatively small, perhaps at most 6 to 15% of all Americans. However, the number of tattooed individuals who are or have been in prison is significantly higher, 32%. A study which focused on the relationship between tattoos and the criminal way of life found that criminals get tattoos for reasons such as self-indulgence, a need for gratification, a deep commitment to delinquency and criminality, and a disregard of their consequences, and concluded that tattoos endorse the criminal lifestyle. Tattoos have been shown to be associated with high-risk behavior. Several studies have linked tattoos with deviance, personality disorders, substance abuse, risk-taking behavior, and criminality. One scholar writes, "The criminal world universally considers tattoos an inseparable part of their symbols." If a person has a visible tattoo, it does not mean that he or she is or will be a criminal or a threat. However, a tattoo is certainly one indicator, which may mark an individual as an anomaly worthy of further observation. For example, in Iraq, certain groups of insurgent fighters wore tattoos of 3 small dots forming a triangle on one of their hands. Observing this would immediately warrant further observation or questioning of the individual. Clothing and other artifacts. Humans across all cultures use clothing and other artifacts, for example, jewelry, badges, accessories, emblems, and images on clothing, to communicate associations, beliefs, and status. Gangs, teams, military forces, insurgent organizations, and other organized groups often wear some type of clothing or emblem unique to them. This is branding. It is done to allow group members to identify one another, to provide a sense of unity and solidarity, as well as to distinguish the group from other competing groups. Often the emblems chosen have symbolic significance. They tell a story of the group's beliefs, origins, goals, or other important aspects of collective ideology. Individuals select clothing and other artifacts to communicate messages to others. On the day that Timothy McVeigh was arrested, the same day he blew up the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, he was wearing a T-shirt with a picture of Abraham Lincoln on the front and the Latin phrase, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus always to tyrants. On the back was a quote attributed to Thomas Jefferson, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants." John Wilkes Booth was said to have cried "Sic semper tyrannis" after shooting Abraham Lincoln. McVeigh wore the shirt because it displayed his ideology, which drove his decision to attack a federal building and kill almost 170 people. Individuals within groups also distinguish themselves by their clothing and other emblems. Videos of insurgent leaders often show the insurgent leader with clothing, jewelry, weaponry, and other items that set them apart from their subordinates. Gangs in the U.S. wear clothes, which in some form or fashion exhibit symbols that represent their gang. These symbols may be specific colors or certain professional sports emblems. A recent study reported that drivers who displayed bumper stickers, territorial markers, were significantly more likely to exhibit road rage and other aggressive behavior. It appears that the mere presence of territory markers has predictive value in determining aggressive driving, as does the number of territory markers. Although the study was not able to confirm that hostile bumper stickers were related to more aggressive driving, it is not too far of a stretch to suspect that individuals who display hostile or threatening messages may be more prone to aggressive action than others who display neutral or friendly messages. A bumper sticker that reads, "Violence solves everything," is a much different message than one that reads, "Embrace peace." Iconographic baselines and anomalies. Iconography is not a behavioral indicator like biometrics, kinesics, or proxemics. Rather, iconography is a deliberate display, communicated via signs and symbols, of a person or group's associations and beliefs. Combat profilers should immediately begin to assess the iconographic baseline for any location in which they operate. Combat profilers should look for patterns in the iconography of the environment. What groups are represented? Are the messages positive or negative? How do the locals respond to the iconography? A population will either support, tolerate, or reject messages communicated through public iconography. If the locals support the group and its messages, they will demonstrate this through their behavior. They will begin to mimic the messages, signs, and symbols. They may display the iconography themselves. They will be proxemically drawn to it. Locals who simply tolerate the iconography will not mimic the messages, but will continue to allow the iconography to be displayed. Locals who reject the iconography will attempt to conceal or destroy it, for example, painting over graffiti. Additionally, if the iconography is offensive, or if the locals are intimidated by the group that has created and displayed it, locals may be proxemically pushed away from the iconography and may exhibit signs of discomfort around it. There are two main anomalies related to iconography. The first anomaly is the sudden appearance of or change in iconography. New types of graffiti may pop up in an area, or the messages of the graffiti may change. For example, local iconography display messages that are supportive of the local security force, but then suddenly begin communicating negative messages. The second type of anomaly is the attempt to hide or conceal the iconography when Marines or security forces are present. Both of these anomalies relate to public